Blog Talk Radio.
United is on the air. We got a packed show for you tonight. We have lots of goodies, some movie news, the latest reviews. We're going to examine a little bit of Siskel and Ebert's legacy in honor of Roger Ebert's new autobiography that just came out last week.
Cool.
And we got an interview to top the show off
and
a great song to close the show off with. I mean, you know, I just previewed the whole thing. There's no reason to go through with the actual show now.
Yeah, no, really. Everyone can go home now.
So how are you, man?
I'm all right, man. I'm doing well. What's going on with you?
Not much. Saw several movies this weekend that we can discuss that you've seen as well, I'm sure.
Okay. All right. Sounds good.
And our fellow movie geek, Chris, will join us right after this interview segment. So let's get to the interview segment now at the top of the show. Have you seen this movie yet, Tucker and Dale versus
Evil? Yeah, no, it's available on demand. I just haven't gotten a chance to watch it. I've seen other things on demand in the last couple of weeks, but not this one. But I do want to check it out eventually.
I saw it on demand yesterday, and I'm telling you, I laughed out loud all the way through it. I thought it was just great.
Cool.
And I didn't think I would. I was like,
right.
Tucker and Dale versus Evil. And so this isn't going to be my cup of tea, but, man, it was the most entertaining movie I've seen so far this year.
Okay. That's a great endorsement. I mean,
and it's a first-time director in Eli Craig. I mean, he comes from the industry. I believe his mother is Sally Field. But, I mean, this is a really confident film and very, very funny and well done. It's available now, as we said, on demand. And it'll be in theaters starting this Friday. No, next Friday, I'm so sorry, the September 30th, which is next Friday. So however you're able to check it out, I seriously recommend you do, because me personally, it's going to be on my top 10 of the year list, which is unusual for me, because this kind of movie usually isn't.
Right, okay, wow. That's like I said, it's a really strong endorsement. Holy smokes.
But then again, I mean, how often do horror comedies work? I mean, not often.
I mean, it's Shaun of the Dead is the first one that comes to mind. But, yeah, I mean, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
all right. This is interesting. I mean, now you got me where my interest is peaked. Hopefully next weekend I'll check it out.
I can't wait to talk to you about it. Okay, so here is Eli Craig talking about his new movie, Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Well, you know, I mean, I grew up in sort of a hillbilly family, and I had to defend hillbillies after all these movies that have come out. Wrong Turn, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Hills Have Eyes, Deliverance. You know, they keep sort of pumping out these movies where the guys who live in the backwoods in a cabin are automatically evil, you know, killers that want to cut the college kids to pieces and like use the skin, the flesh of their face as like a mask. So I just wanted to do something different. You know, I was kind of looking back on that whole genre of the that sort of backwoods slasher genre. And I thought it was just kind of ripe pickings to make fun of and twist the stereotypes on their head.
Yeah. And that is what's so great about it, because, I mean, we've seen these movies ad nauseum. I mean, the Kids in the Woods movies. But I'm so thankful for a movie of this genre that actually surprises you. But was that a delicate balance to get right? First of all, the horror comedy genre, I would think that those would be two competing kind of genres because they're both a similar release from audiences. They both inspire a similar release. Was that a delicate balance to get to get right?
I guess I'm too new and probably too stupid to know any better. So I just thought this was a film I wanted to do, and I believed really passionately in it. But I also came from the point of view, I guess, where I think horror comedy does work. And, you know, I looked a lot toward films like Shaun of the Dead, and a little bit toward Zombieland, though that came out, that actually came out a little, you know, later on. But, I think the Shaun of the Dead worked really well to ground the characters in a sense of reality in sort of an outlandish world and an unreal world. And even for the great horror films, like that's what the great horror films say, you know, The Shining or The Exorcist especially, they kind of couch the character drama in realism, even though the world is surreal. And I think horror comedy has the potential to do that as well. As long as you don't take it too broad or make the strokes too big or make it too goofy to me, like, you know, maybe Scary Movie, I think, makes it too broad and focuses on these pop cultural references and to get the comedy. I just wanted to do a character-based comedy within a horror world, and I had a lot of faith in it. So I just never lost that faith, and everyone tells me now it's so hard to make it work, and I didn't really think that much about it while I was doing it.
Well, and the actors that you've cast as your two lead hillbillies, I mean, they are phenomenal together in that they're very genuine, and they don't play the stereotype.
That's it. I mean, and that's what we discussed all the way through production and before production when I was casting. It was critical that we try to do all the backstory we needed to flesh out the characters, to write out biographies, so that these guys understood they weren't playing caricatures. You know, the script could be very broad and kind of caricature-y, and the script was funny, but... for instance, when I was hiring Alan Tudyk to play Tucker, he was concerned that this was going to be kind of a Scary Movie type, or it could be a Scary Movie type comedy. And I had to reassure him that wasn't what I was looking to do at all. I was really, even though the characters on the page sometimes read, you know, very big and very broad in some ways, that I wanted to make them as real under the circumstances as possible. And so we all took that knowledge and sort of ran with it. And I couldn't have asked for better actors than Tyler Labine and Alan Tudyk and Katrina Bowden as well to all play the realism of the situation.
They're all fantastic. Yeah, and they're great together, because I would think that, you find an actor that's right for a particular character, but that doesn't assure you that they'll be good, they'll have good chemistry with their co-stars. I mean, they really seem like a genuine friendship, those two.
Yeah, and in fact, they kind of are at this point. But they weren't, and on day one, you know, the day one for shooting was only the second day they've known each other. So it's really a testament to their acting that it seems like they've known each other for their whole lives. But I think part of that has to do with the rehearsal process we had. I mean, just in one day, it was actually more like 2 days, I guess, we had time to really go into the backstory, and I had them sort of talk to them about writing out their biography and figuring out where they were from. And then they took it and ran with it. And I know Alan and Tyler went home practically together that night and just hung out all night together. And kind of came up with a frame of reference for these characters. And the first day we were shooting was at the store where Dale approaches Allison with the scythe over his head and stuff.
Right.
And it just, that scene really sets the tempo for the whole movie as to how good of friends they are. And that was our first day of shooting.
Wow. You know, you've been, this is your first feature that you've directed, if I'm not mistaken. But you've done a lot of acting. I mean, acting is in your blood. And I'm curious, when you think of what you yourself need from a director as an actor, do you apply that to your own directing style?
Yeah, well, I mean, fortunately, I kind of studied acting more than I really did it professionally, and I had a few roles professionally, but in some ways, it never really felt like my thing. I'm somebody who really likes to kind of watch other people shine, and I like being behind the camera, and I take great joy in being a director and being able to provide the tools for, you know, really talented actors to shine. So I don't know. But the training for me was invaluable because I did spend quite a bit of time studying under a acting coach named Larry Moss, who was really he's sort of a world class acting coach. And so I really understand the process. And having been in front of the camera, I can understand how you can hear a line in your head and it doesn't exactly sound the way you want it to when it comes out. And letting go and not trying to have the process be exactly what you as a director imagined, but have it be fresh and new and whatever it is in that moment. And so it's like a live performance each time you see a scene. And I always try to get something new and fresh and have it feel improvisational, even if it isn't.
Yeah. Do you know, though, especially in your first time out on a feature, do you know when it's working, or is there always an uncertainty?
Well, there's always an uncertainty. And for me, I think you know. I mean, you kind of know in the back of your head, but you don't want to admit it. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I knew when the scenes were working. And because we didn't have a lot of time, as opposed to saying, okay, we got a good take, let's shoot it again and get one for safety. I never did that. As soon as I got something I wanted, I moved on. And in part, I can't say I spent a lot of time on set with him or anything, but I did a film briefly with Clint Eastwood called Space Cowboys. And I had the chance of watching him direct, and I was astounded by how little footage he shot. I mean, when I was acting, it was terrifying because I walked out and did one take, and he'd go, great, move on. And, I think I can do it differently. I want to try it again. He got what he wanted, and he wanted to move on. And I thought, you know, that's really affected my style, because I've seen a lot of directors go, okay, yeah, that was good, let's try another. And then they try another, and if they got what they wanted, it's time to move on, is my feeling.
Right.
And it worked for this low-budget kind of shoot, because we just didn't have time to shoot different kinds of movies. I had one movie in mind. That's what I shot. If we had three takes, we were lucky.
I think so, too. And that economy of direction that you have with this film and you spoke of with Clint Eastwood, I mean, it doesn't give you an opportunity to second guess yourself, and I think a lot of times it gives the movie a particular energy that wouldn't be present otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that. I've as a producer, I haven't produced features, but I between kind of graduating from film school and then getting this feature, you know, financed, I worked as a producer on commercials and music videos. And I used to watch directors shoot, okay, this time you come in the door and I want you to be really happy. Okay, the next time you come in the door, I want you to be sad. Next time you come in the door, I want you to be indifferent. And the actor's going, oh, okay, sure. But to not know what you want, I think, is a great failing, because then you give it to an editor or you're working with an editor, and too many choices, I think, in the editing room can create more problems than good things. You want choices, but you don't want to have two different movies. So there was a real economy in this and an energy to every take, because the guys knew, you know, we would move on pretty quick.
Right. And you hear from actors all the time, what do you want from a director? And they all say, I want him to know what he wants.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's frustrating for an actor if you're hearing different things. I mean, you know, granted, for a music video, it's just sort of a different world. But still, I think any director should have a clear vision of what they're looking for.
Tell me about the. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Sorry. Tell me about the look of the film, because you're dealing with the comedy genre, which has a very distinctively different look than the typical horror film. But
yeah.
But your film is really a great combination of both.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm glad you say that, because that was my goal, was to shoot mostly the look of a horror. I mean, I wanted to look a lot like a horror film. But then I have three different points of view, really, within the film. I mean, there's Tucker and Dale's point of view, which is sort of a little bit wider, a little bit broader, a little bit brighter. There's the college kid's point of view, which is that these guys are evil, so it's a little bit more perspective-oriented. I was shooting a lot of shots maybe through tree branches and kind of going for a bit more of like maybe a handheld horror vibe. And then there were the flashbacks, which were intended to be really a horror film, like kind of gritty and not shot much like a comedy. But I wanted all three of those to fit together without feeling like a film school project. You know, here's what I'm doing. You know,
yeah.
I wanted it to feel somewhat free flowing and maybe work on more of an unconscious level than like, oh, I see, you know. But all of that was couched, I mean, in this idea that there were these two fish-out-of-water comedy characters that basically found themselves inside of a horror movie. And so that it should feel, the world that they're in should feel like a horror movie.
I sat and I watched it here at home, and I laughed out loud many, many times. And I mean, I rarely do that. I rarely laugh out loud at films. I just kind of snicker. But so it was terrifically effective for me. But I would think that this would be a terrific audience movie. So when you unveiled it to an audience for the first time, what did you go through as a filmmaker giving your baby his first public view, and how satisfying was that for you?
Well, the first real public view was at Sundance in front of about 800 people, maybe, you know, and I had just finished the mix. In fact, we had missed the deadline to get the film into Sundance's hands, you know, but they extended it to us, and then they extended us the deadline again. And so I just finished literally about 5 days before Sundance started and before our screening. So I had a HD cam tape that was hot off the deck, and nobody had seen. And I made a lot of these decisions toward the end of the process completely on my own, sitting on my laptop, on my home computer with my hard drive, you know, making choices about how the film was going to begin, how some of these flashbacks were. I mean, I was making big choices just in order to get the film into Sundance at the time, at the right time. And so when I finally saw it in front of an audience, it was like, I don't know, it was like, as if you waited to get married before you had sex. and then you finally do, and it was orgasmic, you know, because it worked.
Well, you've watched it a thousand times, but I would think that it would be like almost watching it for the first time when you unveil it to an audience, because you see it through their eyes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially for a comedy, because there's so many things that you just don't know whether they work or not. And, you know, and I was told by a lot of people that this was not a funny film. I mean, I went through a really difficult process of in post, and you do the best you can, but you start to think I can't be the only one that's right here, and you fight for your film. But if a lot of people are saying you've made the worst film ever, I try to go, okay, well, maybe they have a point. Well, how can I fix this? So I really had no idea that the film was going to work. I edited it from my own taste, and I was not getting positive feedback really until Sundance. So
wow,
it was really tremendous.
So what's coming up for you? Do you have something else in the pipeline?
I do. You know, and there's one of the things, because I've had so much fun working with combining horror and comedy. You know, I've been a little hesitant to jump on that boat again, because I think I pulled it off the first time, and I'd hate to not pull it off the second time. You know, sometimes too much information is a bad thing, and not knowing what you're in for is a good thing. But I do see an opportunity with the sort of devil child genre. And I was such a fan of these films like The Exorcist and The Omen and these things like that, that I'm playing around with twisting that into a bit of a horror comedy as well. A bit like maybe Meet the Parents meets The Omen. You know,
I love it already.
Yeah, so you can imagine how it would be hard to deal with that sort of situation.
Oh, shit. Let me do the talking.
That's a good idea.
You can't stay put.
I'll handle it. Hey.
Hello, sir. Good to see you again.
Yep.
But we have had a doozy of a day.
A real doozy.
There we were.
Yep.
Minding our own business.
Yep.
Making some improvements to my new house.
The new house?
When all of a sudden, out of nowhere, these kids started killing themselves all over my property.
Yeah, this one right here, he dove head first right into the wood chipper. Even Woody right back there.
There's another one up over there who shoved a spear through his gullet.
Straight through.
Now, I don't know how much experience you've had with this, but we were scared shitless.
Scared shitless.
You must think that I'm some kind of moron to believe a story like that.
No.
Oh, no.
No, sir.
Not a moron.
Not
open-minded. Let me get this straight, because I'm having trouble understanding something.
What?
You say you were just working when this kid ran up and stuffed his head into that wood chipper?
That's a fact.
That is a fact.
And I think maybe they might be trying to kill the girl that we have inside.
What girl?
You know what? She can maybe explain the whole thing if I hadn't knocked her unconscious with a shovel. On accident.
On accident.
You've got another one inside and you say she's unconscious?
Yeah, she's in my bedroom.
Well, you better show me what you done with her.
Yeah,
right this way. Let's show him.
Okay,
come on.
Let's show him.
Great idea.
Okay.
Okay, that is writer-director Eli Craig. The movie is Tucker and Dale versus Evil. It opens up in theaters September 30th, but you can get it right now on demand on whatever cable provider you're with.
Yeah.
I think most have on demand now, right?
Yeah, no, they all have on demand. I know you can get it from Comcast, and I'm sure you can get it from Fios. And, I'm pretty sure.
And I have Bright House.
So there you go. Then you're definitely,
you
can get it everywhere then, I would imagine.
Exactly. Okay. We're going to wait a little bit. Chris is going to come on the line very soon. So I don't want to necessarily talk about anything that he would be able to have input in. But did you see what was the weekend box office like? Do you know? I know
Lion King just cleaned up. I mean, that was really the that was number one, I think, with $29 million this weekend.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
man, that was a phenomenon when it came out.
It's a smart move. I mean, you know, it was a smart move to do that. So let me just see if I can find out anything new about that. But I'm pretty sure that was a big thing. Let me see what else.
I wonder if this, you know, this is a completely off the wall question, but I wonder if Elton John gets residuals from movie sales or just his soundtrack.
I think I'm not sure how that works. If he has a damn good agent, maybe both.
Yeah, but. I'm sure he has a good agent. And we all know Elton John could stand to be more wealthy. But,
oh,
yeah,
wow.
So,
here's something. Contagion is number two. And of the three, it didn't look like this on Friday, but Drive was in number three. So, that was didn't look like, because I think some of the other new releases were ahead of it, but it looked like Drive pulled through. So,
Drive pulled through. There you go.
There you go. There you go, folks. So Straw Dogs underperformed, but, you know. You want to talk about Straw Dogs?
Let's talk about Straw Dogs. Okay, I gave my review on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a chance to see it this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard other opinions about it. I want to hear yours.
There is no reason to remake it. There is absolutely no reason to remake it. I just couldn't. I watched it and I was just like, yeah, it's a Friday. It's a basically your it's your weekend horror movie, essentially. But you knew where this was going. I think they built. They made this such a red state, blue state movie. And I hate using that Stanley Greenberg terminology, but they made them to be so, and especially him, James Marsden, to be so, oh my God, West Coast, you know, whole, you know, he thought his shit didn't smell and everything, he was above everyone, and I gotta say, I was like, okay, and he's the Hollywood screenwriter, and the Stalingrad analogy, I just thought that was landed on really thick. I was like, okay, I get it. He's writing this thing about Stalingrad, and this is going to be a metaphor in the second half of the film. Okay.
Marsden's performance is landing on thick, too.
This is the thing. The challenge in the original one is, do you, Dustin Hoffman, you had to say, oh, my God, he's going to fight back. That's going to be something, given, you know, who he, you know, the actor and the character type and everything. They tried this earlier with the Anthony Hopkins movie, The Edge. Pain, that was originally the one that came out in the 90s, and it was originally called Bookworm, and Anthony Hopkins was playing the bookish guy.
Believe Anthony Hopkins could kick butt.
Yeah, that was no problem. And you kind of believe with James Marsden, he played Cyclops in the X-Men movies, you don't have really a hard time. But Dustin Hoffman, that was a thing. You're like, wow, he's gonna kick. You know, he's gonna go after these guys. He's gonna become, you know, just as evil and beastly as they are. But here, you didn't really care. It is what I told you when you told me the description a year ago. It's like Sweet Home Alabama, extremely violent, extremely you know, rated version. Not to say it tries. I'm not sure about the what was his name, Jeremy, the character who was having the James Woods' daughter kept teasing
right.
and everything going. I saw that. Okay, I see how you're going to use that. I just when all is said and done, I'm watching it. I'm just like, this doesn't really add anything to the Straw Dogs. If it gets more people to see the original film, that's great. But I just thought, I got to be honest, I thought it was very run of the mill.
Yeah, Chris is online. Hey, Chris.
Hey, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, man. Did you see Straw Dogs?
No. Fuck no, I didn't see Straw Dogs. Yes, I did. I did see Straw Dogs, and I was about 16 years old when I saw it. So, no.
Well, this one puzzled me in a couple ways. You mentioned the kind of the slow adult who they harbor in their house.
Yeah.
Her motivation for coming on to him, I can give her motivation in my head, but it's like I'm making it up. Because the film doesn't provide it for me. And there's time and time again when the film doesn't provide you with motivation for the characters,
right.
and you have to fill in the blanks yourself, which is usually, I'm fine with ambiguity. That's
right.
One thing. But I don't know if this movie even knows
right.
what these characters
do. Yeah, I didn't
do what they
get
do.
That. It was every time that part of the movie, focus on, I'm just like, okay, why is this here? And it really is, I guess, just you can see James Woods go nuts, lose it, and that sort of thing.
And James Woods, I mean, it's pretty much a shallow character. It's it's whatever that Brian D. LeBeckwith is, just younger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
I mean, I can imagine that the girl, Chris, I promise we'll get into talking about something you can you could contribute to just a little bit, but just to finish this thought. Like, the girl, maybe she was coming on to him probably because she wanted to aggravate her father.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking
Why she wanted to do that, what that has to do with the mother. I mean, there's a whole story there that could be explored that wasn't.
Yeah.
The whole story of, you know, like I said Wednesday, the whole story of what does that represent, that Alexander Skarsgård was the football player with the prettiest girl, now he has the life that he has, he's fixing the roof, what do those feelings bring up in him when he sees her again, and vice versa, that's not explored. I think it's a mistake for her not to reveal to him that she was raped, because that would have given the motivation for him to all of a sudden turn into the vengeful MacGyver at the end.
That really struck me as very odd. You would not...
As it is now, there's no reason. I mean, it's so sudden, you don't see a change. Like, he takes a stand. Why? Exactly. At this point, why? Exactly? Mm-hmm. He turns into MacGyver all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, because is the motivation for him, is it to protect Jeremy, or is it, you know, your wife has just been, you know, brutalized by two men, raped by two guys, and why she would not tell? I mean, was she ashamed? I mean, what?
Why does, there was another point that I had in mind. Why does he let the second guy rape her? That seems like an odd
mm-hmm.
moment to me, too. I mean, time and time again, the movie was puzzling to me, and I was thinking, do I not get it, or does the movie just not have it?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. All right. This is an interesting email that we got, though, from a loyal listener, Joseph Eisenberg. He was listening to our discussion on Straw Dogs Wednesday after we talked to Rod Laurie, and I guess I made a statement that in the 40 years since Straw Dogs, we've been kind of desensitized to violence, and we're not able to be shocked by that kind of material in the same way that we were 40 years ago. He disagreed, and he looked to kind of other films, and I can't remember the films that he mentioned, and I don't want to try to pull up my email and have my computer freeze. But do you find that that's the case, Chris? Do you think that we're desensitized? Do you think what do you think can shock us now?
There's still, like, moments that are shocking. Like, we don't get shocked by entire films the way we do, you know, the way people were shocked by The Exorcist, you know, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still moments that shock us. But I also don't think that's why people don't respond to things like Straw Dogs. I think it's a whole different argument, a whole different explanation why people don't. I think that those kind of remakes, and this one especially is one of these where it's very obvious that Rod Lurie is a huge, huge fan of the original movie. From everything, from the trailer to the what you're talking about with the movie, and even of course the poster.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious that he's probably grown up his whole life loving this movie, trying to get people to watch it. Like, we all have some movies that we seem to love more than other people, and
mm-hmm.
we try to get people to watch them, and they never will. But as a filmmaker, I think ultimately they get tired of doing that and say, "Fuck it, I'm going to remake it, and I'm going to sort of take a little piece of this movie for myself, and it's sort of going to be mine too. I've loved it for so long, and now
mm-hmm.
it's." Kind of going to be mine too, and that never really works out, or almost never really works out. And that seems like what's going on here. The poster is just so upsetting, because the original Straw Dogs poster was such a great poster.
Yeah,
better than the movie even, actually. The original Straw Dogs not a you know, not even top three Sam Peckinpah movies. I think there's lots of stuff that's shocking, and we get shocked all the time, but it's moments now rather than whole movies.
I think the one movie that stands out, recently in the last 10 years, is Irreversible. That's the one, that's the first movie that comes to mind as being, like, something, like, really shocking, like, turn away from, kind of.
I just don't know if 40 years from now there'll be a modern movie that is written about in terms of shocking the culture, like Straw Dogs did. I mean, Irreversible's shocking, but... It wasn't widely seen.
No, of course, no. If we're going on that basis, Jane, you know, you're absolutely right. I think the problem is, though, in...
Fatal Attraction? I mean, that's a movie that Rod Laurie brought up.
That movie's 20 years old, 25 years old.
Yeah,
right.
25, wow. Yeah, you're right. Oh, my God.
I mean, so look at a movie like Antichrist, Lars von Trier's Antichrist.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something to be said. Like, there are moments that can shock us in lots of movies. But Antichrist is a movie that's trying to be shocking. You know,
yeah.
Like, really trying. You know, like, cutting dicks off and fucking, like, female...
Trying so hard.
Like, trying so hard, and you can't do it. Like,
right.
Ultimately, like, it's disturbing, but it's not, like, shocking. It's not like
mm-hmm.
you got to call your friends up and tell them, guess what I just saw? You know, like, no, it's just like, they're trying to shock me. Well, maybe there is
right.
a little bit of truth to that. But we've all been in movies recently where it's like, oh, shit, I didn't see that coming. But, like, as far as violence, yeah, I do think that we're a little bit desensitized.
Yeah, I think with all the media that we consume, whether it's on TV, on the Internet, or whatever, I mean, you see so much of it. It's like the Jane's Addiction album, Nothing Shocking. I mean, really, unfortunately, nothing is really that shocking anymore. We're just bombarded with images.
Yeah. I don't know that. I mean, the reason why I mentioned Fatal Attraction, that decades from now, I think that movie will be a marker in time for, I mean, for a movie that on a mass level, maybe shocked isn't the right word, but kind of, thrilled people to a different kind of consciousness. It introduced like a new era. It inspired conversation. So I don't know that a movie has kind of shook people up like that. I think that's more and more rare.
Mm-hmm. No, that's
talking,
true.
Are you talking just about the shock factor, or are you talking about a thriller, or are you talking about a movie that's like sort of a phenomenon that everybody's talking about, like, you got to see this?
The original Straw Dogs, people were talking about, is it anti-feminist? Is it fascist? There was a bunch of argument about it. Fatal Attraction, it shook people up. That's what I'm talking about. It doesn't have to be a horror film or a vengeance film or something. Fatal Attraction was the same thing. It shook people up, and a lot of it was just the period of time it was released, with singles crowds and AIDS and all this kinds of stuff. People kind of inserted their own, paranoia into it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, it is an interesting point because, we bring up a lot of topics on the show, but, I'm kind of stumped. We really don't have a lot of movies that are sort of shocking in the kind of way you're talking about.
Yeah,
now.
I mean, we have shockingly bad movies that we have,
nothing's even shockingly bad anymore. It's just like, it seems like they're trying to make it bad. And then people do
try. Stunningly mediocre.
Yeah. The last, I can't think of a movie beyond Fatal Attraction. I'm sure there's something that comes close, but yeah, those kind of things are few and far between. And they have always been few and far between. It's not like back in the 70s, every movie there was a movie, a shocking movie that was coming out, but I think maybe it's getting even more stretched out now.
Mm-hmm. However, I mean, you did have Bonnie and Clyde, you did have The Wild Bunch, you had Straw Dogs, you had Clockwork Orange.
Right.
I mean, they were in faster succession back then.
Yeah, definitely closer together.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen anything, Chris, lately?
No, I haven't been to the movies. I've got a kid now, and that takes up all my time. I do, like, beg and plead to be on the show tonight, so that's where I'm at.
Okay.
I work 70 hours a week, so.
Right.
Yeah. We love you, man. We want you on the show
glad
as much
you're
as
here.
Possible.
I mean, glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here. The early part of parenting is more of a TV time. It's very, very hard to get 2 hours to away from the baby. So that sort of stuff will come back in a couple years, but it's pretty tough to get 2 hours away, actually. So, TV works better.
We do need to talk about Drive. So maybe this will be of interest to you, and you can ask us questions about Drive.
Right.
Are you interested in Drive?
I am. Drive is one of the movies that I would like to see. I'm not, again, like, if something comes out that I'm dying to see, when Girl with the Dragon Tattoo comes out, I will see it. I want to see Drive. It's not, I don't have the drive, ironically, to go, to get out there right now. And go see it. It's not like that kind. It's not that kind of level. But I definitely do want to see it.
Right. So Jerry, you posted something. You're relatively crazy about this movie.
I don't know what it. Maybe it's just because I've liked Ryan Gosling since The Believer, and there's just something very mesmerizing about watching him on screen. And I was really enthralled with his performance, but I was also enthralled with everyone's performance. Bryan Cranston, especially Albert Brooks, Ron Perlman, Carey Mulligan. I mean, they're all, like, terrific performances. But it was just the way the film was made, the look, the soundtrack. It was mesmerizing. It was really – I felt hypnotic. I felt the whole movie was hypnotic. And it's – and I think we should say this because I didn't say this yesterday, but I think there are moments of extreme violence. I think that's something that should be said. And that's not a negative. Just be warned that there are some and stuff that you really, from characters you wouldn't, actors you wouldn't expect it from. But it's just very well done. It reminded me, I had the same kind of reaction with Old Boy and Sexy Beast. And mm-hmm. I was just like, this is so good. I mean, I like, you know, we saw Warrior last week, and I like that a lot for different reasons. But that was another very, I felt, hypnotic movie. But this one was just, and that, with the movies that this gentleman has made is the Pusher trilogy, Valhalla Rising. What else has this director done?
I don't know. That's what I haven't read word one about him or the mm-hmm. making of it or anything.
But he got an award on a Cannes this year, right? Didn't he? He got the director's award or something?
Yeah.
I don't know about that. But he made that Bronson movie as well with Tom Hardy.
That's right. Bronson was another one that Roland made fun of me for liking. how I remember movies on the show, if Roland makes fun of me or not. But
well, I just got out of it.
I want to hear what you thought. I mean, good or bad, I want to hear.
No, I mean, I loved it.
Okay.
It is a mood film, so either it's going to have the effect of kind of lulling you in a hypnotic way, like
mm-hmm.
you and I had,
right.
or it's going to put you to sleep. So it's you have to...
Yeah, that's a good point to bring up, because if you don't like the style, the director's style, I think that will tune you out of the film. But if you
got
do
a definite...
like it, it's I think
yeah.
it's a, no pun intended, it is a ride worth taking. And it's fascinating, because what I like is you... It's like with, all right, with what I liked about Warrior was there you saw everything in the trailer, but it's how those situations were brought up in the film that I thought was really neat. Because you figured, okay, you have your one way, you're watching a trailer, you think, oh, this is how it's going to unfold. Not at all, and I really appreciate that. Here, I just like, you know, Jamie, you've always taught that film is at its best is a visual medium, and here you have to really pay attention to stuff and pay attention to what's going on the screen. I like that.
Right.
I don't know. Do you think? Let me ask you this. Do you think it's not a very, in a sense, dialogue-heavy film as it pertains to plot?
No.
It's, you know,
essentially Ryan Gosling. I mean, to give you guys a sense of the style of it, it is pure. It's like if Adrian Lyne, Michael Mann, and David Lynch had a baby, it would
mm-hmm.
be this movie. And it's very like almost steeped in 80s. Tangerine Dream
mm-hmm.
Feeling, you know, so it feels very retro.
Yeah.
Gosling is playing like an archetype, like almost like the man with no name, which
man
he doesn't
no
have a name.
I was going to say Mad Max only because I think Mel Gibson had more dialogue in The Road Warrior than Ryan Gosling.
Well, he doesn't, he's not given a name in the movie.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You really don't know a lot about him.
No,
and
not at
so
all.
There's not a lot of kind of development in the movie. That's not the movie's goal.
No.
I mean, you're not. I don't really see what she sees in him, other than he's kind to her and her child.
Right.
But as monosyllabic as he is in this movie, I mean,
that's
I can't
good,
really
that's
believe.
Good, you're right. You're right. You're right.
Yeah, but I mean, so the movie is all attitude and style and
mm-hmm.
and just the feel of it is why you go to it.
Yeah.
Albert Brooks is cast as like a gangster
mm-hmm.
Who turns out to be very violent and shrewd. It's stunt casting, but it works. I don't know. Were you ever able to see that character, though, without thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm seeing Albert Brooks do these things? I mean, is the character distinctive enough?
I think the character is distinctive enough in the sense that, you know, I know what you're saying, because what's the closest he's played to this would be the Out of Sight, but that's a very comedic still.
Yeah,
part.
Tongue-in-cheek, yeah.
There's nothing,
yeah.
He is not, I mean, maybe there's one line I can think of is funny, and that's it. It's a very different performance, and I bought it, though. I bought it, hook, line,
yeah.
and sinker. I mean, I had no trouble believing that.
He's good. He's
yeah.
very good. He's not given I wish he was given more of a character to play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a mistake. I don't know how you do this structurally, but I think it's a mistake to have the first waves of violence occur before you see Albert Brooks be violent.
Mm-hmm.
Because it kind of shaves off the shock and tension
mm-hmm.
of Albert Brooks's violent scene
mm-hmm.
when you've already been confronted with some really violent, gory
mm-hmm.
stuff. Nothing is more effective in the movie than when Ryan Gosling goes in there with a hammer and a bullet to the guy's head.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The suspense of that. It doesn't even have to happen.
Right.
You're just waiting for it to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You
kind
are.
Of a grotesque
right.
idea.
Mm-hmm.
But Gosling's good, and it's a great part for him because it's all It's all with his eyes. Mm-hmm. You're constantly trying to read him in this movie. He is a mystery. I tell you what, the performance that I was impressed with the most is Bryan Cranston in this movie. I think he created a vivid, unique character.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too. The only other two movies I've seen him in this year are Larry Crown, which is, and the Lincoln Lawyer, but that was a very small part. And I was really impressed with his character. That's another thing with, you just sort of, you look at him and you know what he's had. You don't need the Albert Brooks character or whatever. You know that this guy's just had the worst luck in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You just
mm-hmm.
know that. I mean...
And that's a great noir character.
Yeah.
I mean, what this essentially is a circa 1980s film noir. That's
mm-hmm.
what Drive is.
Yeah. I mean, it has that mood. Especially, you're right, with the music. I mean, the music is totally, I felt like you said, Tangerine Dream or even Vangelis or something. I just totally, I got that. I mean, definitely very steeped in the 80s.
And then the Doug in the chat room says, is Ron Perlman over the top? I mean, going with that kind of film noir aspect of it, I mean, he is, you know, he's villainous. He's this
mm-hmm.
big, hefty, you know, the look of him is so unique.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a heavy.
I mean, that's what he's, and I think he's supposed to be over the top. I don't think it's not a bad thing for this movie for him to
it's
play.
It's not Scarface over the top.
Nothing's quite... I don't
that's
know.
The barometer, right there.
Yeah, that's the barometer. It's definitely not Scarface over the top. I didn't think it was, but I thought he was good. I thought all the performances were good. But you're right. You don't know what is her motivate. You know, why is she so trusting? Or maybe it's just. I wonder. Did she ever think her husband would get out of jail?
Probably not.
Okay.
But at the same time. At the same time, if they really develop a relationship between them,
mm-hmm.
The movie might fall apart because
mm-hmm.
the movie's strength is in the mystique of that lead character.
Yeah.
And you don't want to demystify him that much.
You're right. That would be a huge mistake for the movie.
Yeah, yeah. So we both give thumbs up.
Yeah, we've had two. I mean, you think about it, it's very rare this time of year that you have two really solid warrior Drive, and also Contagion, too, that you have, like, solid, really solid films
yeah.
coming out. Usually it's October.
I've liked all of them, and my favorite of all of them is Moneyball.
I'm looking forward to that.
That's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Chris, let me get your take on this, because I was watching this yesterday. I rewatched the last season of The Sopranos.
Whoa.
And, it's such a good series, and so
mm-hmm.
sad. Whenever I catch glimpses of them, I'm so sad that it's no longer on
right,
the air. But everybody talks about the finale, and nobody talks about the show right before the finale and how supremely exciting that show was.
Right.
But I guess the obvious question is, what do you think happens at the end? Now that several years have gone by, when you reflect on it, is Tony dead?
I'd say the opposite of how you do through the years, and I was just having this conversation the other day. So many other great shows have come along, like Lost and Mad Men and Breaking Bad, and
mm-hmm.
shows that the trajectory of the show is a little bit more interesting, a little bit more upward. The trajectory of the show Sopranos was sort of rising, and then falling the rest of the way down. It sort of peaked in the third season and never quite got that good again. I don't remember the show just prior to the final episode. As time has gone on, I could give two shits about The Sopranos. I watched it when it was on and I liked it, and I remember basically for like the final three seasons just waiting for it to strike back up again, and it never did. I feel like David Chase sort of changed his mind halfway through the show. He started making a mob show, then when it got popular, like a lot of artsy-fartsy guys do, he decided that he was going to turn it into an artsy-fartsy kind of thing. Like, no, it was never about the mob. It was about the bullshit. It was about the mob at first, and that's why everyone liked it, except he turned it into an art house show at the end, and it was boring. I couldn't care at all about the last season. I whether he lived or died, I don't know, because he didn't show it. He cut it off like a stupid art house movie or something like that, you know. And I don't think that there is a right answer. Like, I don't have heard people argue both ways, and I don't really I hope he's dead, because I don't want another Sopranos season, because it can't be any worse than the last one.
Well, wow, I misjudged your reaction to The Sopranos big time when I asked that question. Well, David Chase said that everything's in that last episode,
mm-hmm.
and I guess the reason why he went subtle and ambiguous with it is so we'd still be talking about it.
And if that was, then he's right. I mean, we're still talking about it, for better or for worse.
But you talk about these markers. I mean, we talked about Fatal Attraction and Straw Dogs. I mean, The Sopranos represents that, and that's why you have as good as TV now that you have.
Yeah, but it doesn't hold up. The show just doesn't hold up. Right? You know, I mean, we see it on, like, you know, the first couple seasons do hold up. But, I mean, it's undeniable that the trajectory of that show was just completely downward in the last three seasons. They got totally off track. It wasn't an exciting show. It wasn't interesting. The characters were just sort of meandering. There didn't seem to be any point. They were just sort of, the story was not advancing forward at all. It was just wallowing in itself.
Well, that's the big danger of it. And I guess that when you have a multi-character plot like that, and your focus is on just the family and giving everyone their own strands of narrative, I mean, that's a danger. But what I always found with Sopranos, that whenever you counted it out, it would come through with something that would shock it back to life. Like all of a sudden at the season finale, when it became scenes from a marriage, like the big fight between he and his wife about her love for Furio, and it became a whole different animal altogether than you were expecting. And there are moments like that scattered throughout the series.
Mm-hmm.
It had a way of revitalizing itself for me.
I think it did too. I especially think the introduction that season. I don't remember what season it was towards the end, but when Steve Buscemi and Robert Loggia, that season, and I thought that was a really great injection into the those characters.
Yes.
Really good. And I mean, I thought it was. Look, I read one. Actually, I think it was the second guy that called into our show. I forget Lon. He had said, I remember during this time, that He actually thought The Sopranos never had a altogether perfect season. He just thought but each season had very memorable shows. I don't know if I agree with that, but
each season had one show that was a classic Sopranos.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it was too long to wait for one. But
well, I think was the problem was there was a long gap in between the seasons, wasn't there? I mean, we're waiting and
yeah.
And that hurts anything. I can see that. But let me. Well, do you think he lives or dies?
I think he dies.
You think he dies?
Because I think a lot of conversations leading up to that episode point out that he dies and the manner in which he dies, and you never see it coming, and all of a sudden it's black. And he's having that conversation with Bobby,
mm-hmm.
who ends up being killed in the next to the last show.
Right.
And I think if you consider that, like, what an awful way to die, because he's sitting with his family, and he looks up at his daughter the moment she walks in the door, and that's the moment he gets it. So, I mean, that's kind of a terrible,
right.
tragic, violent ending that you don't see, but you can imagine. But I was pissed. I was pissed at that last episode. And I remember calling, I think it was Mark, Chris, and we were like, can you believe this bullshit? But upon reflection, I mean, I liked it more and more. But I see your artsy kind of, and he did that continuously through the latter part of the show. And I mean, I agree with that. As the show grew more respectable, he started to slather it all on, you know. I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, but I think what you said, it's also The Sopranos and HBO in general really forced everyone, and also on network television too, to really start making great television again. I mean, we are living through, I think, the last decade, a golden age of television, personally.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many good shows on. And
HBO has yet to pull in the numbers that they did with Sopranos. I mean, they
did
close
with
True Blood.
Not even Game of Thrones or Boardwalk Empire?
No.
Or True Blood?
No.
What about True
they
Blood?
They get close with True Blood.
Is True Blood their biggest hit outside
yes.
The Sopranos?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that pulls in, I'm not exactly sure, but between 3 and 5 million. Sopranos gave network television ratings a run for their money during
mm-hmm.
certain times.
That was true. That was very true.
You see Red State, Chris? I mean, that's on TV.
Like I said, short.
It's 88 minutes.
It's not just about getting out of the house. It's more about time.
It's
time
getting that block
yeah.
of time, that chunk.
Right.
Would you choose to block out that amount of time for a Kevin Smith movie?
No, I would go see something like Drive,
okay.
or I would go see something like Warrior. I'll see Red State one day. Number one, I'm not a big fan of horror movies. I do like Kevin Smith. You know, I mean, if I were going to go to the movies right now, this show, my involvement in this show has really devolved into this. If I were going to go to the movies, this is what I would see. I would probably go see Drive. Well, no, that's not true. I would probably go see Contagion.
Yeah, I would say. I thought Contagion.
Drive after that. You know, I don't go to the movies. That doesn't mean that I don't follow the movies. I know everything that's going on. I still go to the websites. I read all
mm-hmm.
the news. You know, I still have an opinion about everything. But this is the time of the year where I often, this is always my sort of, you know, for all of us, I think, the time of the year when we see fewer movies. It's just that there happen to be better movies this year, and you guys are getting to see them. I'm still staying home, so.
No, I mean, you're like I used to be, and that I'll be again, I'm sure. I mean, before I started to go to screenings and stuff, I never went to the theater to see movies. I mean, very rarely. So, you know, you're like me.
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys a question, though. Let me ask you guys a question, because you brought up about Kevin Smith. I've noticed this since we started doing this show, not because of the show, but just and also just being online, I guess, especially the last decade. While I thought people really like Kevin Smith, it seems in the last 4 or 5 years, people really hate him. I mean,
yeah.
there's like an extreme, I don't know, maybe hate's too strong a word, but there's an extreme dislike of Kevin Smith within the last 5 years, I've noticed. And I didn't notice it before because I also didn't pay attention to it. But I'm not just talking about like IMDb message boards. If you go by that, everyone's hated in the world. But... What is it? What is it that people don't like exactly?
Well, it's not, I mean, he's not making good movies in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Okay,
you know what I mean?
There's an argument. That's a strong argument that you can make. I agree with it. The first half of the career is definitely, cinematically, is a lot more interesting than the second half.
He stopped making good movies. I mean, his personality is still the same. If anything, his personality has gotten bigger. You see him on more shows. You see him as a talking head. You even
mm-hmm.
see him as an actor in movies and stuff like that. And he's on the circuits, he's on the radio shows, you hear him on XM radio, he's got his smodcast and all that stuff. That side of his career has sort of increased in the last 5 years, and the movie side has sort of decreased in the last 5 years.
He'd be the
even though every
yeah,
movie he makes,
he
says it's great. So,
yeah.
There's a direct correlation there, I think. If he were concentrating more on making good movies, people wouldn't be talking such shit about it.
Right.
You know.
For me, it's like the charm of being an amateur, it wears off after a while. I mean,
yeah.
There comes a time when there's no excuse for you to be an amateur anymore. That being said, Red State, I thought was good.
Do you think it's his best movie?
No, I think that's Jersey Girl.
Okay, all right, okay. there's a cult
yeah.
out there for Jersey Girl. There's everything out there, but there's a cult
the
for
Jersey
that.
Girl cult, yeah. they're all going to commit mass suicide, I'm sure, that cult. But I think Red State is the most confidently executed film he's done. It's the one with a vision.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. Is it in my top 10 or 20 of the year? No. But
no, I can't go. I would have to watch it again. I actually have one... It's such a small thing, if you miss it, you could probably miss it, but there's something that a character says in the film that I think sort of hurts the whole thesis of the film.
Which is what?
Well, John Goodman's talking on the phone when he's still at home before he's dispatched.
Yes.
He says something to the effect, I don't know the exact quote, but he says, no, they're much worse than the Fred Phelps West Baptist church people. They just like to sue people. And since we all know that Michael Parks is playing essentially Fred Phelps, I thought to bring that up, I thought he defanged his argument. I know that's a minor thing, but I actually thought that that should have been cut out, because it is, you are attacking Fred Phelps. This movie is literally an indictment. What you see is wrong, and I have no problem with that, but to actually mention Fred Phelps by name and then sort of get him off the hook, in a sense, I was like, wow, dude, that's just not smart. That sort of hurts the argument.
Now, is Phelps the leader of the Westboro?
Yeah.
Okay.
He is a leader of the Westboro Baptist Church that does all the protests at all the military funerals, and they go protest everywhere now.
Right.
And I thought, I was really surprised, that really caught me off guard, because I thought the whole point of this film was, in a very bold thing to do, because these people are relentless, directly try, in the guise of the Michael Parks character, I forget the character's name, but this is essentially Fred Phelps. And to bring up Phelps, I thought, in the film, was a mistake.
Yeah.
It just really caught me off guard in that way.
No, that's a good point. I see that.
But I agree with you. It is competently executed.
And Michael Parks is good. Michael Parks is great.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, in that scene, and at least when the one kid is in the cage, the other one, and he's giving the sermon and everything, that's a disturbing scene. That whole sequence is disturbing.
Yeah. What was he? He was in Kill Bill. He was the guy.
He played Esteban, and he played the sheriff.
Played the "Stay Thirsty, My Friends" guy in Kill Bill.
Right.
Right. Anyway.
I'd have to look up. I'd have to go look up what other movies he's in.
Speaking
of performance by him, though, that's been
very good performance. Yeah. And speaking of Kill Bill and Tarantino, this was a bummer, Chris. Kevin Costner no longer in Tarantino's latest movie.
Yeah, I was disappointed to see that too, because and when I heard that, I thought the article I read actually said, like, what project could possibly deter you from taking an against type role in a Quentin Tarantino movie? And I was thinking about, like, the movies that Kevin Costner's made over the last couple years, like fucking The Guardian with Kutcher, and
that was a movie called The Guardian, you're right.
The New Daughter or whatever, the other fucking straight-to-DVD thing he did, the, like, thriller, I don't even know what it was, it's on Netflix, and I was like, yeah,
I've seen it.
I'm, like, thinking of, like, all the movies he's made in the last couple of years, and I thought to myself, you know what, no, I'll bet it's not one of those. The only thing that could deter him from a Kevin Smith movie, or from a Quentin Tarantino movie, is got to be a Kevin Costner movie. He must be working on a project of his own.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. I'll bet. Is that what it is?
He's directing another movie.
The Postman 2?
Of course.
Right.
I knew it. I literally did not know
that. The Postman always rings twice. That would be the ideal title for a sequel to The Postman.
That would be.
I mean, God. He is. I mean, that's the excuse they're giving. I also think it's Cold Feet.
I don't know. That's a little harder for me to believe. Like, I don't know why.
It's hard
that,
to believe bravery and choices from Kevin Costner, given all the movies you've just mentioned.
Yeah, really. I mean, some real winners there.
Yeah, but there's no reason to think there's no real reason to think that. I mean, he's a guy, he goes on interviews and things like that. Who knows what this part is, so that's another thing. I think it's just ego. I mean, it's just pure ego. Like, I'm doing my thing. He signed on to it and then signed off of it, so.
He's the guy that trains the slaves to fight each other. He's the most despicable character in the movie.
Oh, that's the part he was going to play. Okay, so he has sort of like like in Spartacus, essentially, like that kind of part. Okay, wow. All right.
That's a career-reviving role, potentially. I mean, nobody's seen it, but, I mean, you could imagine
it might be. Do wonders for him.
I'm sure it would be career reviving in the John Travolta sense, which is career reviving for 5 minutes.
So he can ruin it again.
Yeah, you can shock. I worked in the hospital. You know, I mean, we could shock someone back to life, but that doesn't mean they won't die in 5 minutes.
Oh God. No, it is. I mean, look what Paul Thomas Anderson did for Burt Reynolds, and then Burt Reynolds really pissed that away.
Right. Look what Burt Reynolds did for Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, I know. it would have been. I know. The only thing I seen Costner in that I like was The Company Men. That was the only thing I've seen him in recently that I thought that he's, you know, that he was actually decent in.
Costner's solid at playing Costner, and you know, in Company Men, he played Costner, so maybe Jamie's a little bit right. It could be true. I don't know that we have any reason to think that, but it's a decent theory. But the bottom line is, whoever gets that part, you won't be sitting there watching it. I promise you, you won't be going, fuck, I wish Costner got that role. That will not be happening.
I know that Gerald McCraney is in it now, too. I don't know. He's not taking over Costner's part,
Major,
I don't think. But
Major Dad?
Yeah.
Interesting. Give it to Cranston. Cranston seems to be making every fucking movie these days. So.
I think he likes to reserve
Treat
a
Williams
spot.
Treat Williams is rumored to be in it.
Who? Yeah, yeah. Treat Williams.
Wow.
That's a treat.
Yeah. Not really. Well, that's got to be the Costner part then, because both of them are the same flavor of vanilla.
Mm. You're not a big fan of Treat?
Are you kidding? Are you? Name the last riveting Treat Williams performance.
Trying to
the
think
Devil's
of things to do in Denver when you're dead was the last thing I can think of, but
okay. Yeah, decent movie. Was it a riveting Treat Williams performance?
No, but I thought, you know, the way they're talking, though, speaking of comeback performances, everyone thought that was going to be the thing that brings him back. I mean, the movie only played for a week around here, but I mean, yeah.
Things to do with the movies when you're
on
dead.
The forefront to have a comeback, you know.
Yeah, I know. I mean, because the movie that was supposed to make him a big, the Prince of the City bomb, so.
Right. It's like trying to make, it's like trying to give Billy Crudup a career comeback, you know.
No, I liked it. A lot of his early performances, but yeah, you're right. I mean, he never became a household name. You're right about that.
Yeah, I like him. I like the guy. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Billy Crudup's a shitty actor, but like, they tried to make him an A-list star for like 15 years. Like,
yeah,
I kept reading, like, he's the next A-list star, he's the next, and it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't give him a comeback role.
That's true. That's very true.
It took a while for Clooney to get there, too. I mean, everybody saw his kind of charm and charisma on TV, and they tried to make it into a feature film star, and it took a while to get going, but eventually he did.
The weird thing about Clooney is, like, he still doesn't make successful movies. He never really did. Like, outside of the Ocean's 11 films, like, he really...
He's not considered a box office...
He's not, not a popular star, you know? Like, and we think, when I think of movie star right now, he's probably the first name that pops in my mind, but...
Yeah.
He doesn't make very popular, very successful movies. It's really fucking bizarre.
It's something that he'll be the first to tell you that. I mean, because that's what they're for the part. I mean, they thought Michael Clayton, which is an excellent movie, but not exactly, you know, didn't pull in the audiences. But
did you say Michael Crichton?
Michael Clayton. I said Michael. I did not say Michael. Michael Crichton has gone to the great beyond. You know, there are all these films that they thought, oh, this will. This will be the one. And while he gets a lot of critical success, and like you said, he is definitely what you think of when you think of a movie star. The audience is not there. For something like Up in the Air, it's just not there.
I'm sure The Descendants will be the same story, but before we start the Siskel and Ebert thing, let me ask you guys, because I did Jason's show last week where we did early Oscar predictions. What do you think would be a front runner in terms of picture this year?
Jesus.
This is a test.
Yeah, it's a little early.
I don't. I think everyone wants to say Tree of Life,
right.
But it's.
Oh hell no.
But no,
right
I don't
now?
Think. I don't think. I mean, I think back then we did. I wouldn't say it right now, no, because the movie just. I don't know, something like that. I think if we're going to believe what we're, I think it's going to be the I think the front runner, while maybe, and I think you're right about The Descendants, but I do think The Descendants is going to have so much buzz around it when it comes out that they're going to push that. But it could be War Horse.
Yeah.
It could be The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I would not rule that out. The Ides of March, maybe. I'm not sure, though. The Iron Lady, you cannot rule out.
I would Stephen Daldry's movie, the 9/11 movie.
The 9/11, these are all Oscar bait movies. Now, has there something that's come out already?
I have a couple ideas. Okay. Chris, what were you about to say?
I was going to disagree with absolutely everything Jerry just said, with the exception of War Horse. The exception of War Horse, and I would say that as of this moment, if they were going to give the best Oscar picture to anything, then it would probably be The Help right now.
Oh, The Help, yeah, you can't rule out The Help.
The Help is this year's Blind Side. I mean, if you have to, like, you know, water it down like that. But go ahead.
I don't think that that's watering it down. I mean, it was a popular movie. It was a well-received movie. You know, it's the kind of movie that the Oscars like to nominate every year, not just last year, not just The Blind Side.
Right.
And it's a much, much better, it's a much better movie than The Blind Side.
I would agree with you there, yeah.
Yeah, it's not in the same category as The Blind Side.
No, what about things like Jane Eyre, or that was good. But I think it's so far back in the year, though. I don't see that really.
Where they don't have to nominate 10 movies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
War Horse, the argument against War Horse, if people are this forward-thinking, is that next year Spielberg will have Lincoln. And Lincoln seems like the passion project that could win awards, especially with Daniel Day-Lewis in the lead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
I don't think they are forward-thinking, are they?
No.
No, I think most of them are going to die before next year. They're so old.
God.
I think that The Artist is a front runner.
Mm.
I think Tree of Life could very well be nominated. I wouldn't be surprised if Tree of Life got nominated for director, not picture. I think that The Ides of March is out because it's seen as a kind of an entertaining movie, but a lesser prestige movie, probably along the lines of The Candidate. I think that the Descendants is the prestige Oscar bait movie for Clooney.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's going to get nominated for. It's going to be Clooney. It's going to be Christopher Plummer playing Barrymore for Best Actor.
Mm.
I think for Actress, it's going to be between Meryl Streep and Glenn Close, and I think Glenn Close is probably going to get it because this is something that's obsessed her for decades, and she's going to campaign hard for it. And it's the kind of role that, you know, it's her yentl, because she's playing a man.
Right, right.
It looks pretty good. I mean, I think Moneyball will get a screenplay. Brad Pitt could get nominated. That could be the movie star performance that gets nominated, the popular performance in that Best Actor category. But we don't know what they're going to come out with that'll surprise us. With Girl with Dragon Tattoo? No. I think that might get Christoph Waltz for supporting, because that's the performance that has gotten the most recognition.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie itself is seen as too slight.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Trying to think what else is coming out. We've mentioned some of the big ones so far.
There's a Jason Reitman movie, Young Adult, that Charlize Theron. Apparently has a great juicy role in.
Oscars aside, what would you say is the best movie yet made this year?
Mm-hmm.
Like if there was a bomb going to be dropped tomorrow and you had to declare your favorite, not best, but favorite movie of 2011.
It'd be between Drive and 13 Assassins for me, one of those two.
For me, it would be The Smurfs, I think.
That's a bold opportunity.
I'm nothing if not bold. And
what
blue.
About Tower Heist? Are you going to go with that?
I mean, you know, it follows the, you know, it's like this year's Avatar. It's got blue people.
Go with the blue.
Any movie directed by 2000 Flushes, I'm just a big fan of. Actually, Moneyball, I've enjoyed as much as anything I've seen this year. So, I might say Moneyball. I mean, I'd have to really go back through in the year, but that's the one movie that comes to mind. So, I mean, if I have a favorite above that, then you would think that it would come to my mind right away, and it didn't. So, I'd say Moneyball.
Well, it's a weird time of year to be trying to think back of all the fucking shit in March and April and stuff like that. You
but
know?
You had a lot of like really good small films come out like the first quarter of this year, like Win Win and Jane Eyre and things like that. But I just don't see those films being remembered by Oscar voters. That's just the way it works. I mean, they're both very good movies, but I just don't see that happening.
Well, and Girl with Dragon Tattoo could be not an Oscar kind of movie, but it's a strong story. I mean, it's a solid. It could represent a solid piece of storytelling that could impress them.
Well, don't you think what Daniel Craig said a couple of months ago in an interview, that he said it's the first movie that he's seen in a long time that was a movie geared towards adults. It was an adult film, very mature, and and it's Fincher. And like I said, I wouldn't really be behind it if someone else, but it's Fincher really loves the material, and he has really. I can't see him doing a bad job with this. I really can't.
No.
I can't either, but don't get confused. I mean, he didn't get nominated for Seven or The Game or Fight Club. And
No. It's not until Benjamin Button that he...
Right. It's only
but he
in the last
and Zodiac
years.
Was completely ignored. I mean...
Yes,
right. It's only in the last couple of years that we start associating Fincher with the Oscars, and far before that, we were associating Fincher with, being one of the best films.
Yeah.
And he hasn't been nominated for the darker stuff. I mean, Social Network and Benjamin Button aren't the darker.
No, they're not. No.
Yeah.
But it's just, I'm just going on that basis because of those two films. But it's just like, they seem to like to go back and nominate.
Right. He's on the radar.
Yeah. You don't think the Muppet movie is not going to get anywhere, no traction with the Muppet movie? Okay.
I think it could be really successful.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how successful it'll be with little kids. I think it could be successful because the parents that are crazy and nostalgic about the Muppets will take their kids to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next segment. This is what we're going to talk about. You guys ready?
Yes.
Here we go.
Sound a little excited, James. Sound less excited, Roger. That's why we're redoing it, because of what you did. It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert at the movies, and we've got three new ones.
And the movies, not at the movies. And that's why we're doing it this time.
It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert in the movies, and we've got three new ones.
Dennis Quaid in The Big Easy, Michael Caine in The Fourth Protocol, and Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman in No Way Out.
That's this week on Siskel and Ebert. And the movie. And the asshole.
That was great.
And that's Roger.
Siskel and Ebert. Now, why we chose to talk about them a little bit tonight is because Roger Ebert has a new memoir out. It's his latest book. It's called Life Itself. And it's really good. I mean, anyone that is in tune with his blogs, which his blogs have taken a highly personal turn, in the past few years, since his health problems, and he's become a very emotional writer, and those entries have been fascinating. Are we still on the air?
Yeah.
By the way, okay.
Yeah, we are.
The movie is obviously a memoir. It takes this tone as well, and you hear about his growing up, his love of the movies, his interviews that he did, the days that he spent with Robert Mitchum and John Wayne and Herzog and Scorsese. And then his illness, his rapport with Gene Siskel, his theories of criticism. I mean, it's all there. It's well worth a read if you're interested in criticism or how his thinking about movies developed. So it's available now, and you can purchase it here on our homepage. Life Itself is the name of it. But Siskel and Ebert, I mean, it's been years and years since Gene Siskel died.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about their contribution, what do you think their major contribution was to film or film criticism, Chris?
I think we probably all agree that their biggest contribution was sort of making it palatable, which is, and immediately that's what we think of, but the truth is, I haven't read a lot of Gene Siskel's writing, but Roger Ebert is also quite a good writer. So it's twofold for me. Number one, I think of immediately, he helped to make it so palatable for the masses. You know, it's not people like Pauline Kael, as much as I like reading her because she was a great writer. but she was a tremendous blowhard, and it was very difficult, I think, for the masses to read people like that. And a lot of the early film critics, it's very obtuse and it's very scholarly, and they sort of get lost in it, and there's a lot of references, whereas Roger Ebert sort of made it, palatable, made it a little bit more digestible for people. Certainly brought it to the mainstream with television and things like that. But I also don't want to sell him short and make him sound like he's, you know, the McDonald's of film criticism, because the truth is, I think that right now he is literally the best film critic that we have. And we have many very, very good ones that I love, but I don't think that anyone is as good a writer as Roger Ebert is, and he always has.
Yeah.
The counter-argument to that is that Siskel and Ebert as a team, the people that were worshippers of Pauline Kael or Andrew Saris, the intellectual criticism, felt that they, as a team, stupefied and kind of mass-marketed film criticism. So that's a less polite way of saying palatable for them.
Yeah, well, that's TV, though, isn't it? I mean, you can't. When Roger Ebert gives one of his reviews, like take his review of, I don't know, something like Fargo, like Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert were doing the show together at that time. So they did a show, and you can probably go online and look at their, you know, verbal review, the two of them, of the movie Fargo. It's probably something like 3 minutes or something like that. But you can also go online and read Roger Ebert's written review of the movie Fargo, and it's probably not the same thing. The TV version is what people consider to be dumbed down. And in that sense, Pauline Kael and those sorts of people that would say that are right. It is true. That TV clip that you get is a dumbed down version of film criticism, but that shouldn't confuse you into thinking that Roger Ebert is a dumbed down film critic.
Let me add this, though. Before the internet, especially before the internet, sneak previews when it was on PBS and then at the movies, when it went into syndication in the, I guess it was the early 80s, for most of us, that was the only way you could find out about films like Burden of Dreams. I remember when they reviewed that, or Fitz, you know, or that was, you weren't going to, unless you subscribed to New York Times or New Yorker or something, or a film magazine or something, there was no way that you were really going to be able to find out about some of these smaller films that they championed, or films that you might, when they do those special episodes, or little known films that we like that you probably haven't seen, and they were right, we hadn't heard of them, and it was very important in that day and age when no one even knew what the internet, where we take everything for granted these days. That was a really important service they did. They really introduced you to names of directors, actors, and actresses, films that no one had really in the mainstream had heard of. No one was talking about. So you would see these foreign movies or these independent movies, like a John Sayles movie, especially John Sayles, or Jim Jarmusch, or things like that. And it was just like, wow, that's really cool. I didn't know you could, because I don't think you had any shows quite like that, unless you had the local TV reviewer who was reviewing a bigger movie 9 times out of 10. And that's
still the singular kind of power of the film critic, but it was on a mass scale with Siskel and Ebert, just by the nature of their medium. But the past few months, or the past month or so, on the new At the Movie show that Ebert produces, they've been rerunning past episodes of sneak previews, like the early days of Siskel and Ebert together. And they've been themed shows.
Right.
Where they have a little bit more time to breathe and examine films. They did a Women in Peril show, like what is behind the whole I Spit on Your Grave, the endless horror movies where women are being chased and tortured, and then they did the homosexuality in movies. They did a whole show on that, and that allowed them kind of a larger format with more breadth to really examine trends and things. So it wasn't all encapsulated 6-minute segments.
Right.
But speaking of violence against women, here's a clip from a Siskel and Ebert review and an argument that they had. We have a couple of clips.
Cool. I love their arguments.
This is a good one.
This
is a good one. This is Blue Velvet.
Blue Velvet is a movie that really challenges you to think about your reactions to it. And my reaction is, I think this movie is cruelly unfair to its actors. It was directed by David Lynch, the same man who made Eraserhead and Dune, and he's a talented director. You can see that here in scenes that have a lot of power. But he asked Isabella Rossellini in this movie to be undressed and humiliated on the screen, as few actresses ever have been, certainly in non-porno roles. And then he tries to take the edge off her shocking scenes by turning the whole thing into some kind of a joke. Well, either this material is funny, in which case you don't take advantage of your stars, or it isn't funny, in which case it shouldn't have so much campy and adolescent dialogue along with the really powerful sexual scenes. Sure, the movie's well made, but the more I thought about it, the less I liked it.
Well, I liked it, and I thought about it a lot, and I think you may be on the wrong tack in trying to feel sorry for Isabella Rossellini, because after all, she consented to do what she did on the screen, number one. Number two, I'm sure she's walking around wherever she lives, New York City or whatever, and survived the whole experience, just like Janet Leigh survived the shower scene in Psycho. So I don't think that that's pertinent. I think what's exciting about the film, and it is challenging, is it starts out with flowers and sunlight, and it's a happy little town, and then we dig deeper, and we find out it's a nasty town, or at least a couple of people are nasty. And I sat there, and this did for me, and I used the Psycho example again, this did for me what Psycho did, as a lot younger, which is eyes open, and oh my God, we're really getting in over our heads. And that's an experience which is challenging, shocking, but mesmerizing, and I like the picture.
Well, first of all, I don't think I'm on the wrong tack with Isabella Rossellini. In the first place, the movie was shot in two halves, so she had no idea, making her part of the movie, that all of the stuff outdoors and in the daylight was going to be smarmy and campy and funny with all kinds of in-jokes. And secondly, it seems to me that we can't divorce our reactions. It's not how Isabella Rossellini reacts to the fact that she's standing there nude and humiliated on the lawn of the police captain's house with lots of people watching. It's how I react. And that's painful to me, to see a woman treated like that, and I want to know that if I'm feeling that pain, it's for a reason that the movie has, other than simply to cause pain to her.
Well, I think that the reason is that the film is a thriller and a shocker. I mean, there are people that get hurt badly in real life,
that's
and
right.
I think that this is a legitimate one. This is not a simple, mad slasher
movie.
Then
why is it a comedy?
Because he wants to set you up. He's a director, and he wants to play you like all the directors, the great directors want to do. He wants to play you like a piano, which is have you smile and then swing you right into the... some depression.
Yeah, well, I think if somebody wants to play me like a piano, he'd better get some music that's worth listening to.
I think this is a good song.
That is a great line.
That is great.
That is a wonderful line, even though, I mean, I don't necessarily think it applies to Blue Velvet, but that's great. That's one for the books. So that's, I mean, that's kind of an intelligent, different kind of course of discussion on something like Blue Velvet. But that's his M.O. on most Lynch films, up to Mulholland Drive, which was really the first one that he liked.
Because they both hated Lost Highway. They actually, in the advertisement, it was two thumbs down, I remember.
Yeah. I mean, Siskel, Ebert didn't even like Straight Story.
Wow, okay. Oh, my God. Wow.
I mean, he definitely didn't like Wild at Heart, and Siskel did. And that was his argument, that he kind of makes this very intense atmosphere of dread and violence, and then he kind of tips his hat and jokes about it. He didn't think he was brave enough to carry on with that tone. So, I mean, Chris, when you hear that, I mean, how do you discern their two personalities? Because, really, Ebert's come into his own now since Siskel's death, but they were together, they were more than... they were as individuals, I think.
Yeah, no, they absolutely were. And that, the thing about that is, people were always trying to say, well, one of them likes the mainstream movies and the other one likes the art house movies, and it always sort of got confused. Talked to one person who thought one liked the action movies and then the other vice versa. It's not really true. Couldn't really put either one of them into a little box like that. It changed. Sometimes Ebert would like the art house movie and Siskel wouldn't, and sometimes Siskel would like the action movie and Ebert wouldn't. It was always different, and that's what was great. They had a chemistry together.
They had great,
like, you know, the great actors do, and you know, just like Redford and Streisand did, and The Way We Were, and just like Clooney and Jennifer Lopez did in Out of Sight. Like, well, not quite like that. There was a slow motion sex scene. Well, like Lemon and Mathew, then, for that matter. You know, I mean, they had a great chemistry, and I think that they did care for each other, and it came off on screen. And they also both had the one thing they had in common more than anything was that they both really, really loved movies. Now, I think, like you do, that Ebert comes off like a pompous ass in that review. He probably wasn't getting laid at the time. and felt sorry for the girl. I don't know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But his complaints about the movie certainly didn't have anything to do with the movie. Like, he obviously was complaining about the way the actor was treated. And absolutely right. She agreed to make the movie. She's walking around New York somewhere with $1 million in her pocket. She's fine.
And to think that Isabella Rossellini didn't know the rest of the movie, that she wasn't.
Yeah, I was like, what?
It's nonsense. But that's the thing. They had lots of exchanges like that that were fantastic. Mm-hmm. They also had great exchanges where they agreed on things. Mm-hmm. They could sometimes riff with each other, and they would go back and forth, you know, about, and what about this, and what about that, and, you know, they just really got giddy talking to each other about movies that they really, really both, you know, loved.
And Fargo is one of those. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But here's another argument from them.
Let's hear it.
Enough with this harmony. But you would say that Ebert was seen as the mainstream guy and Siskel not so much?
I wouldn't say either one of those things.
Yeah.
I would say I don't think that you can fit either one of them into it. I think it was constantly changing. I don't think that – and they tried to do the same thing when it was, A.O. Scott and Michael Phillips. Like, they tried to do sort of – people tried to put them into the same box. And it doesn't really work that way. There's no – with Siskel and Ebert in particular, there was no nerdy one and no mainstream one. There wasn't – didn't work like that at all.
Well, here's one that they had it out about. This is two different clips because they continue this argument. But these are, you know, delectable. So here they
are. Some of those scenes, especially the first two, might make you think that Full Metal Jacket resembles the dark irony of Stanley Kubrick's classic 1963 anti-war film, Dr. Strangelove, but you'd only be about half right. There is irony in this movie and satire and comedy, but there is also way too much routine war footage. The opening scenes in basic training recycle material we've seen before, all except for a brilliant performance by Vincent D'Onofrio as a pudgy weakling who the Marines turn into a psychopath. That was him we saw looking up at the camera in that earlier scene. And there is more recycling at the end of the film, which is devoted to that firefight in the ruins of a burning city, a sequence that was shot on a giant set and looks like it and reminded me more of World War II war movies than of the special war in Vietnam. We expect an original masterpiece from Stanley Kubrick every time out, and this time I'm afraid it's not a bad movie, but it's not original and it's not a masterpiece.
Oh, I think it's very original and very close to being a masterpiece. I mean, first of all, I think that the stuff that we see, the training sequences, are absolutely startling. Even though this is familiar material, I think that image that we got of that guy is explosive and I'll never forget it. Mm-hmm. Second, the fighting here is a different kind of fighting than in Platoon. It's city fighting and it looks different. And it's a whole different war, and he's playing this film, I think, at a whole other level. Platoon was about embracing the soldier and giving the soldier credit for this crazy world that he was in. This fighting, to me, is about the mixture of joy in fighting and the absolute fear of being killed, in the sense of when there's this guy called Animal who charges, I was so excited for him. Mm-hmm. And this is the guy I'm supposed to hate. And then when I see a sniper go on an American and Kubrick has his camera push in, I feel for the first time people getting attacked. I think visually this is the strongest movie I've seen in a long time.
First of all, I didn't think it was that visually exciting except for a few specific shots that were really great. But secondly, let's talk about that very sequence you're talking about. One of the guy's friends is wounded and he's out there under fire, and the other one says, I'm going to go get him, and he runs out blasting with his machine gun to try to rescue him. Then later, the others come up behind, and we can clearly see where the sniper is. Then when you get to that reverse shot and he pushes in, that is a cliche, Gene. I mean, when I saw that push, I was so disappointed in Kubrick. This whole sequence is taken right out of absolutely routine grade B Republic
Roger,
World War II war movies guys running out there to try to save their buddy and somebody else shooting at them.
I have never felt a kill in a movie quite like that. Ever. Vietnam film.
Not in Apocalypse Now, in The Deer Hunter.
Not like that.
Well, then in that case, you're going to love The Late Show because they have kills like that every night in black and white starring John Wayne midnight.
But they don't have movies like this film, Full Metal Jacket.
I disagree. Okay. And I disagree particularly about the part that you like.
Well, that's just one scene. I like the whole film. It's full of great scenes.
And then it continues.
Wow, I did not know that Ebert hated Full Metal Jacket quite that much. Holy.
It continued at the end of that show because they did a Kubrick video segment. And this is great. And this is a good point about criticism and how you judge one movie against another.
Mm-hmm.
If I can press play on this. It would
when
be...
it comes to films about war and warriors, mm-hmm. Stanley Kubrick is a master.
He knows what he's doing. But, you know, the real buried subject here is our disagreement about Full Metal Jacket. And I would be very surprised if you liked that movie in 30 years as much as you like this one today. I don't think it's going to hold up that well. It's not one of his great films.
In the world of films as made today, Full Metal Jacket is a film to recommend. Full Metal Jacket is a very, very fine film.
My opinion is the Full Metal Jacket is not Kubrick at the top of his form, which we've just seen here.
Roger, it is not as good as those two mm-hmm. films, which are among the greatest films ever made.
Mm-hmm.
But for you on this show to give thumbs down to Full Metal Jacket, I think is a gross mistake. I think it is a film worth
seeing.
I'm
trying to put the movie in a context, and I'm trying to tell people that it is not as good.
And this is the show where you give Benji the Hunter a positive review and not
Now, Gene, that's totally unfair because you realize that these reviews are relative. Benji the Hunter is not one-third the film, one-tenth the film that the Kubrick film is, but you know that the same thing happens, that you review films within context.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not fair for you to compare those two reviews. And you know it, and you should be ashamed of yourself.
No, I'm not.
Now let's take another look at the movies we reviewed this week.
That's what I miss about Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah.
You don't get that from anybody else. I mean, it's all this chemistry. So, I mean, Chris, who do you side on with that argument?
Well, there's a couple of different arguments taking place. There's the argument about Full Metal Jacket, and then there's the argument about how you can compare, you know, about film criticisms. Like, I understand what Ebert's saying, because I do not think that, by the way, it's extremely nerdy for us to be able to pick out their voices. I don't think they mentioned their names there, except we all know who's who. So.
Yeah.
I agree with Ebert about Full Metal Jacket. I don't think it's one of his better films. I know exactly the push that he's talking about. I do think it's cliched, and I think you can see it in lots of other war pictures. The movie's nowhere near what Dr. Strangelove or 2001 or The Shining are. It's not even in the same ballpark. And I would be surprised if even Kubrick wouldn't have told you that.
Paths of War.
Paths of Glory. As far as the film criticism argument goes, yeah, I agree with Siskel. I agree with Ebert on both of them.
You know what? I do too.
You can't compare the Benji review because you're reviewing a movie for children and Full Metal Jacket is not a movie.
Definitely
for children,
not for kids. Yeah.
I mean, you definitely have to review a movie based on its own merits and its
own
goal.
What I'm trying to do.
But Siskel's counter argument to that was: so the if a movie aims low and it achieves it, it's a better movie.
Yeah. Well, that's where the star rating or the thumb rating fails.
Yeah.
That's where that sort of thing fails. But you have to take that into account. I mean, it's just like, it's like different subjects in class, you know. I mean, a grade in math is not the same as a grade in English. 100% in math is not the same as 100% in English. One is objective and one is subjective, or creative writing, for that matter.
Right.
You know.
You know, another thing, I mean, I have a clip from their review of Crash, too, that's...
I remember that.
Siskel,
me too.
Yeah. Well, let me just go ahead and play it.
It's so nice to hear them. Yeah. I mean,
you do. Yeah.
Here we go. Here's the two of them
it's
talking about
It's not for
Crash.
A mainstream audience, and despite a big-name cast and a director who typically stands for quality, I was more depressed by this picture than impressed. In Crash, James Spader plays a filmmaker with a penchant for public sex who develops a sexual relationship with a woman played by Oscar winner Holly Hunter, whose car, get this, he crashes into by accident and kills her husband. Pretty hard to watch this scene and not say, oh, come on, this is ridiculous.
A trainee radiologist, then the service manager at my garage.
You had sex with all those men in cars? Only in cars?
Yes, I didn't plan it that way.
Later, James Spader's character looks on from another car as his blonde wife, Deborah Kara Unger, is willingly terrorized by a whacked-out performance artist played by Ilias Koteas, who likes to reenact celebrity car crashes. Performance artist character is truly twisted. He would like to drive cars that have been involved in celebrity car crashes, and he has theories about car crashes that are plainly idiotic, I think.
The car crash is a fertilizing rather than a destructive event. A liberation of sexual energy, mediating the sexuality of those who have died with an intensity that's impossible in any other form.
Crash was directed by David Cronenberg, the adventurous Canadian filmmaker of Scanners and Dead Ringers fame, and my honest reaction is that the subject of Crash left me feeling empty, not even challenged in the am I hip enough to get it way. Crash has some beautiful bodies on view, but also some ugly ideas, and as I said, I think it really did leave me cold.
Well, of course, it was intended to leave you cold. I think I liked the movie a lot more than you did. I would like to make it clear that most people are probably going to hate it, be repelled by it, or walk out of it just as they did at the Cannes Film Festival.
Why is that?
Because it's too tough for them to take.
Oh, you mean, well, really Roger.
Is. Yes, it is.
You
it is.
Think,
it
wait,
is.
Wait a second.
Sex involving wounds and blood and scabs and braces, a lot of people don't want to see it, don't want to have anything to do with it, don't want to get close to
it. I want to be clear. Do you think that that's my objection, the nature of my objection?
I felt that your objection was that you didn't really bring any sympathy to what he was trying to do, and I'll tell you what he was trying to do. He's trying to make a pornographic movie without pornography. He's taking the form of a pornographic movie without the function or the content. He's substituting car crashes for the usual erotic stuff in order to show the mechanism of human compulsion and obsession.
Okay, but wait a second.
And it's a fascinating study of the way the mind works,
wait
the connection with images that we connect with sex.
Roger, it can't. I'm going to review the movie, and then I'll review your review. My objection to what you said is that I think that there are, quote, soft porno stuff in the picture. When you see sex on the hood of a car, when you see people making
none
it in bed.
None of the sex scenes in this movie are directed in a way to be erotic.
Oh, I think that the one scene in bed between Deborah Kara Unger and Spader, I think that that's intended to be erotic. I think a woman touching her breast, pulling it out of her bra, that's intended to be erotic. And I think it can be erotic. I'm saying that the ideas in the film, said by the performance artist, that somehow this is a connection between life and death, that's a bunch
of
hooey.
Well, you know, the movie doesn't...
It's hooey.
The movie thinks so too, Gene. The movie is about crazy people.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. The movie doesn't argue these people are right, or even that they make sense.
But are they interesting?
Yes.
Not to me.
You've never seen anyone like this before.
I haven't seen a lot of people in bad movies before that I don't like either.
Okay, when we come back, one of this year's Academy Award nominees, Kolya.
It all started with...
Oh, well, good. We got a little bit of a commercial at the
end. Yeah, I got a commercial in 96.
Crash is a tough one, but, I mean, that's an interesting thing, too, because when you see a movie like Crash, I mean, it's so mystifying. How do you go about reviewing it? And actually, their argument over, you know, the whole meaning of the film or whether it has one, I mean, that speaks directly to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's confusing in that way.
Yeah, it's based on a book that a lot of people, you got to hand it to Cronenberg for taking books like Naked Lunch, which I would have said I still think is unfilmable, even with his version, which I find very interesting. It's a very interesting movie. But Crash, J.G. Ballard, with the exception of Empire of the Sun and maybe the sequel, The Kindness of Women, that's not easy stuff to bring to the screen. And in Crash especially, and there are other novels by him, and even his last novel, so I don't even know if you could bring that. I haven't read it yet, but from what I hear, that would be difficult to interpret too. But Cronenberg is the person that you would go to for something like that. But I wouldn't say I was disappointed in Crash, but I can't. It was like lukewarm to me. I mean, I didn't see when you're watching something like that. The controversy is just like, okay, people really just need to get out more, I guess. But
well, one of them is saying I didn't see the point, and the other one is saying there wasn't a point. That's the point.
Yeah, that's an interesting. I don't remember the movie or the book that well.
Any thoughts, Chris? Is there a point to Crash?
Yeah, it's a good book and a good movie. I thought it was a good interpretation of that book.
No, I mean, it's the one guy I would go to at that, especially at that time. The only other director I think is Aronofsky, but, you know.
Yeah, maybe so. And he's sort of the rightful heir to Cronenberg, maybe, in some ways. But I think it's a good book. And I don't feel that way about Naked Lunch, which is another book I read and liked and don't like the movie of it. Back to Siskel and Ebert, like, that's just another example of how great they were both really good speakers. You know, I mean, that was all off-the-cuff stuff that was happening there. They might have had little conversations beforehand about, you know, you actually liked it. I don't know what their thing was. I don't know what
they didn't talk at all. They would go to the same screening. They would walk to the elevator together when it was over. They did not speak at all.
I know that Ebert said the one time that Siskel ever spoke to him during a movie was in Fargo. Actually, that he actually said to him, came over and said, isn't this great or something to that effect. I had heard that before. That's what's so great. This is all sort of off-the-cuff stuff, and they just have had these great little moments. We're looking at clips of them, sort of arguing. There were thousands of them disagreeing, sometimes to this extent and sometimes to a lesser extent, and thousands of clips of them just talking. And it was always interesting. I mean, the show was on for, 25 years or something like that. So it was really, really good stuff. They just had a great chemistry together.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason O'Brien actually sent us a clip. I didn't upload it or anything, but of them agreeing on a really horrible movie, which was Jaws: The Revenge. Just kind of their mouths agape, talking about how terrible this movie was. And Ebert,
I think I remember
Ebert,
that actually. Yeah.
Ebert was like, "Tell me something, Gene. At the end of the first Jaws, what happens? Shark dies. End of the second, shark dies. End of the third, he said, yeah, they die. The shark dies in every single one." And he's like, "So what is? Who is the shark?" And Gene was like, "It's a cousin. It's a family member." it was a very entertaining review. I mean, but there are also time capsules, since these reviews, many of them are available on YouTube and stuff, of oftentimes how wrong-headed they were. Not necessarily wrong-headed, but how history has disproven them. Their take, one of them didn't like Apocalypse Now. Really disliked it.
Well, a lot of people disliked Apocalypse
Now. Yeah, I remember when Apocalypse Now came out, it was, you know...
Right, but not all of those people had TV shows where they could talk about it.
Right, right.
And one of them didn't like Back to the Future. I think it was Siskel that didn't like Back to the Future. Ebert really panned The Untouchables when very few people were panning that movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of other noteworthy ones, like movies, not necessarily The Untouchables, but movies that are seen as classics now that they just completely panned. And sometimes they went back to them and they finally caught on to what they were missing. I mean, they weren't above admitting their mistakes either. But there was some kind of pride that both of them wanted to protect from the other. And they kind of never wavered from that. I mean, you could see in these arguments, neither one of them was going to back down or yield that the other one might have a point.
Yeah. They also did the opposite, which is they would sometimes give really good reviews to movies that were really bad, like as far as the time capsule conversation goes. I remember Ebert giving like his four-star review to the fucking Billy Zane movie, The Phantom. Like, he was talking
four
about,
stars
like,
to that?
Or Knowing. Or Knowing. Yeah,
Knowing is another one.
Well, Knowing, I think he really... that we're already with Knowing. We're in the post...
Yeah, postmodern, he's defending it a lot lately.
Yeah, but what about something like Independence Day that they both hated, and then they went back a couple of weeks later and they said, look, you know, we know a lot of you like it, but it's still, we don't like it. You know, they went back and they made a point about that.
Well, this is the same sort of conversation that you could have about them. Like, when you talk about a movie like Independence Day, it's like, okay, well, the masses love it, so there's something to be said for that. Like, you can talk about how it sucks all day long.
Right.
It's like Dane Cook. People talk about what a shitty comedian he is, except for there's 15,000 people in Madison Square Garden who disagree with you,
right.
You know, and they're all screaming his name. And it was the same thing with Roger. You can make the exact same argument for Roger and Ebert. Siskel and Ebert. you know, Pauline Kael, and I don't mean to put it all on Pauline Kael, but I mean those types of film critics can say whatever they want about the show at the movies with Siskel and Ebert. The bottom line is people love it, you know, and, so making something for the masses is not necessarily a bad thing.
No, of course not.
And they love them together, too. I mean, because their stints on Letterman and Carson, I mean, those are on YouTube, too.
Mm.
Classics, yeah. And a classic moment that's not on YouTube that I found, that I haven't found because it's not on there, is when they were on Carson, Chevy Chase was the guest, and they said, well, what's the worst movie you've seen this season? And they were like, well, it would have to be Three Amigos, which was the movie that Chevy Chase was on the show to promote.
Oh, my God.
Ebert writes about that in his book. And Chevy Chase comes up with the line, like, well, I can't wait till you guys, your movies come out. But then he walked backstage and, like, stood in Ebert's dressing room doorway and said, I don't think it's such a hot movie either, to be honest with you. So the Letterman thing, they'd always, like, invite them on for skits and things. Like, they'd go door to door. That's a really good one. Is there anything that Roger and Gene can do for you while you're out? And he said, well, my roof needs to be cleaned off, like my gutters, and so then they shows them pulling leaves and stuff off the woman's roof. I mean, they were the odd couple. They were the mainstream odd couple, mm-hmm. the real life odd couple, just like you said, the Matthau and Lemon. Okay.
No, they were. I mean, I miss that though. I mean, as someone said, I would love to know what Gene's, you know, Jeremy, the critic in the chat room, said. I'd love to know what Siskel thought about recent movies, and would love to see them. God, talk about movies like The Social Network, Tree of Life, or even the Kill Bill movies and Glorious Bastards. You know, things that Siskel championed. And remember, you know, Siskel was a big champion of George Lucas, and I would love to. They both loved the original Star Wars trilogy. I would love to have seen Siskel's reaction to the prequels. Well, he would, I'd be very curious, we don't have that. So that was always, I'm very sad. But the two of them, there's a spark there you just don't see anywhere else. The two of them, just they had it.
Yeah. You have to have two people that have equal parts respect and disdain for one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you could have that. I think you'd probably have one or the other.
Right.
It's been proven. I mean they tried. So, I mean, look how many different guests they had with Ebert after Siskel left. And a lot of them were not meant to be full-time partners, but they were sort of trying whatever they could. They were throwing whatever they could at the wall to see what would stick, and nothing really did. Roper was as good as it got, and Roper was good. And I'm a defender of Roper. I thought he was okay. Even after Roper, then they tried to pair Roper with everybody under the sun, and then they tried to do, Ben Lyons and Ben Mankiewicz, and then it
that
was Scott and Michael Phillips, and then it was these new people, and everybody is sort of good, and I even got used to Ben Lyons and Ben Mankiewicz, and I even got used to A.O. Scott and Michael Phillips, but nobody's got what Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel had, which was that sort of intangible thing.
Mm-hmm.
You
can't really recreate that.
No, you're absolutely right. But it's a big part of our adolescence and our childhood, watching them. I mean, I remember watching, like, first-run shows. I remember vividly and seeing them on all the talk shows and stuff. Bob Costas, there's also a great YouTube clip, like a two-hour conversation with Bob Costas where they go into a lot of stuff. They clearly respected and loved one another, but that... Mm-hmm. That grew over the years because it really wasn't there.
Right. No. Early on, it definitely wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you. Good show.
Awesome show.
Coming up, we have Joel Schumacher and some other filmmakers in the pipeline. Charles Martin Smith, the director of Dolphin Tale and frequent character actor in movies like The Untouchables and Starman.
Right.
So we got some good programming coming up every Wednesday and Sunday. Chris, buddy, thank you, man.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
All right, guys, it was fun.
We're going to close off the show with something a little inspired by Drive.
Oh, cool.
80s feeling L.A. movie, that's what Drive is. And this is the theme song from another movie in the 80s that dealt with the same kinds of themes and locales. So good night, everybody. I'll see you Wednesday.
All right. Good night, everyone.